critics find it hard to trust number 10.
Trust is something that needs to be earned. It's not a right for the government to assume that they're going to have trust from its citizens, especially when they're putting something in which is so vague that it leaves too many interpretations open.
Priti Patel is actually quite a disgrace to her ancestors. As a migrant, she knows that she came from the backs of those who were colonized by the system. And now you create a bill to oppress those? I think that's pretty fascist for me. And just because she's got a little bit of power, she's forgotten who she's made from, where she comes from. And just because she sits with some people with privilege, I'm using my privilege to use it to create a change for other people. What is she doing?
Having been passed by MPs in the House of Commons last December, the bill is now going through the House of Lords, where peers are suggesting amendments. The bill likely won't become law for the next few months, leaving plenty of time for further protests. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis have marked the 40th day since Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government, Hassan Irlou, passed away. A mourning ceremony was held in the Iranian embassy in Yemen's capital Sana'a on the occasion.
Once again, we express
our condolences to the Iranian people, our brothers, on the death of Mr. Hassan Irlou, who contributed a lot to the strengthening of the ties between Yemen and Iran.
In October 2020, Irlou was appointed as Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government. In that portfolio, he focused his efforts on unifying resistance groups and strived for national reconciliation. He encouraged Yemeni political groups to resolve their internal disputes through dialogue. The senior diplomat also worked toward garnering international support for a mechanism that would end the Yemen conflict and lift the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition.
Everyone knows the stance of the Iranian people and the Iranian government, and that they stand with the Yemeni people against the Saudi-led war. Hassan Irlou was a great person. Despite the short period of Irlou's work in Yemen, he performed his duties to the fullest and contributed to the diplomatic process. When I met him in Iran, he used to tell me that he wished to visit Yemen, and thank God his wish came true, even if it was for a short time.
Irlou was diagnosed with COVID-19 in mid-December, days before he was transferred to Tehran from Sana'a to receive medical treatment. But by the time he arrived at a hospital in Iran's capital, his condition had worsened irrevocably. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that's because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a. Khatibzadeh did not name any country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies have been keeping Yemen under blockade since 2015.
Despite his short tenure as Iran's ambassador to Yemen, people he say the Iranian diplomat played a pivotal role in strengthening the brotherly ties between Tehran and Sana'a. They hold the Saudi-led coalition responsible for his death caused by the deliberate delay of his return home. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from the Iranian embassy in Sana'a.
Stop the Saudi war on Yemen. This is what protesters demand as they gathered outside the United Nations office in Tehran. The rally came in reaction to last week's deadly airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition that targeted a detention facility in Yemen. The United Nations did express its concern for the escalation of the conflict, but protesters here say it's not enough.
We gathered in front of the UN office to say that all of the crimes that are being committed against civilians are happening because the United Nations has given the Saudi criminals a green light by staying silent and watching.
For 7 years, the Yemeni nation has been facing the cruelest blockade and deadliest airstrikes, but no one is doing anything to help the Yemenis.
This time, besides targeting innocent people, Saudi Arabia also targeted the internet infrastructure to prevent their crimes from being reflected to the world. So we are the voices of our Yemeni brothers and sisters, and we are here to tell the world about the Saudi crimes.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched the war on Yemen in March 2015, with the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. Yemen's Ansarullah movement, along with the army, leads the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. These people say, despite Riyadh's strong logistic support from the US and UK, Yemen has made headways against the Saudi invaders and left the kingdom and its allies bogged down in the country.
The enemy is facing a hard time. Saudi Arabia tried its best and plundered its money on American and British weapons to bring our nation to its knees. But our resistance has burst their bubble. And as you see, they are resorting to barbaric ways to achieve their evil goals. But we keep resisting until our land is free.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country, not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine. Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen, which blocks the entry of humanitarian and medical supplies into the war-torn country.
The Saudi war on Yemen is slammed here as a crime against humanity, a crime that these people say continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Protesters here say it's time for the UN to do more than condemning the crimes committed by Riyadh and take action to bring the Yemeni suffering to an end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Harsh winter, hunger, and poverty have impacted daily lives across Afghanistan, with children worst hit by the difficulties combined with malnourishment and famine. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, more than 1 million children in Afghanistan are at the risk of severe malnutrition and death this year. The agency called on Afghan partners and donors to take practical steps to prevent the catastrophe.
We work here to provide our family with food and money. My father is alive, but he is jobless. Some of us are orphans and sole breadwinners of our families. It is very cold, but we have to come here and work.
It is cold, but we take to the streets for work. We polish boots or sell gum and flowers. I have a family of five. Me and my brother are our family's breadwinners. We have no way out.
Here in Indira Gandhi Hospital, as the doctors say, the number of malnourished children has more than doubled since poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan.
Malnutrition has a direct relation with the economic and financial situation of the people. The more people get poor, the more our patients increase. As you know, the recent sanctions and aid cuts have affected our people's economy, so we are receiving more and more patients.
The economic situation has worsened among all Afghan children. Our children are being malnourished due to the shortage of food and nutrition in our country. I call on the world to help Afghan families.
According to the UN, only 2% of the population of Afghanistan are getting enough food to eat, and half the population are facing severe hunger. Almost 5 months after the US-led international coalition hastily abandoned Afghanistan, millions of Afghans are teetering at the brink of starvation. The US and its allies have cut off Afghanistan's access to international aid and froze roughly $10 billion in assets belonging to the country's central bank since August after the Taliban took over of the war-torn country. The UN had already warned that millions of Afghans could run out of food before the onset of harsh winter, and around 1 million children were at risk of starvation and death. 20 years of war and the US sanctions have led millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Children in particular are paying the price of conflicts and crises in their country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Follow us on social media, to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
When it comes to the standoff between the U.S. and NATO with Russia over Ukraine, there seems to be a key development that changes the dynamics. Now Ukraine has come out and said that the U.S. in particular is hyping the situation and has elevated to a war scenario. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is taking a more aggressive stance against Russia and whether the U.S. reluctance to not meet Russia's security demands will end up in a war or not.
Ukraine. A country in Eastern Europe making the headlines these days as it remains a source of friction between its neighbor Russia and backers in the US-led NATO alliance. Corporate media have been trying to portray Russia as an aggressor, bombarding their audience with reports on the country's troop deployment at the border, its military drills, as well as moving blood supplies to Ukraine. Can the international community fall into yet another war trap in a scenario set by the West on a likely Russian invasion of Ukraine? But the question is, given the US-led NATO's eastward expansion and transfer of their lethal weapons and troops bases in Eastern Europe, which one is the real aggressor, NATO or Russia?
When the Soviet Union fell and the Warsaw Pact had already been ended, since then, NATO has added 14 more countries, and nearly all of them are countries that were either republics of the Soviet Union or allies of the Soviet Union.
Ukraine is simply a pawn on the Western chessboard. The U.S. has already sent several consignments of weapons as part of a multi-million dollar security aid to Ukraine while planning more troop deployment. America's allies, Britain, France, and others, have also put their forces on alert. The massive propaganda has even prompted the Ukrainian leader to urge his Western counterparts to avoid stirring panic over a Russia invasion. The West claims Russia is building up troops at the border to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies any such plan, saying its troop mobilization is simply defensive. It says the buildup also aims to counter NATO aggression. The military alliance has conducted several war games near Russian borders, three of them jointly with Ukraine, which is not even a member of the military alliance. So, what's the real game plan? Analysts believe the U.S. wants to integrate Ukraine into the American Empire by granting it a NATO membership, a message hidden in Washington's response to Moscow's security proposals.
This makes the Russians see red spots before their eyes. The same way as any talk of Mexico, say, joining a Chinese military alliance would make them freak out in Washington. It's not a difficult problem.
Russia is seeking to reassert its place in the international arena, and its proposals for a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine standoff seem reasonable. A possible military conflict between the European Union and Russia would entail massive human losses and economic harms. Undoubtedly, Russia has grown increasingly concerned about its security because of Western weapons and forces deployed to its doorstep. The corporate media have played a vital part in fueling tensions, and the U.S., that has waged numerous wars overseas, knows very well how dangerous provoking a war with Russia will be.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, representative to the U.N. from the Schiller Institute, Richard Black.
joins us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We also have radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar, who joins us from Ossining, New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, first to you. You have the U.S. pretty familiar with the stance of the U.S. at this point, very pro-militaristic in nature, 8,500 troops on heightened alert. They have told Ukraine, we're going to keep giving you arms. They just delivered, I don't know how many hundreds of tons of arms based on the latest report. And then you had the Ukrainian pro-war president that I'm going to take on Russia changing stance. Of which his latest quote was, he said, stop creating panic. And he said, we don't need this panic. What is going on here? Is there a change of stance from the Ukrainian president?
It's hard to parse what things are real and what things are for public consumption, because there's a great deal of both moving parts in play right now. You have a pronouncement from Lukashenko, he's basically playing the same role that the Ukrainian president is playing, you know, let me at him, hold me back, you know, like, in other words, you have two paper tiger, you know, mad dogs that are your proxy, sort of like a 21st century version of Yugoslavia and Albania when the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China would have a public dispute. These would be their proxies. First, in terms of all of the things that are going on, who's their hostilities and what's going, there's satellites, networks in the possession of both sides of this that they've been using for 50 years now. They know exactly who has what resources deployed where. So you have a discussion, for example, where people say, okay, well, if they're going to put the troop, U.S. and NATO are going to put troops in Ukraine, and they're going to try to foment color revolutions, quote unquote, in Belarus and Kazakhstan, and you look at a map and it starts to look like Operation Barbarossa, because that's true, by the way. You look at a map of the fullest extent of the Nazi invasion in the early 1940s, and where NATO is now, and where they're trying to go, they'd be starting Hitler's invasion from the front lines instead of from Germany, which is, the Russian strategists are well aware of this. Uh-huh. So people say, well, suppose they put resources in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua,
right,
and then the United States, there's a huge outcry, we will not allow that to be severe consequences. Well, and then you have from Lavrov and Putin a statement that we are now reaching deeper relations, economic, social, political, and military, vague. So that stuff is for public consumption. The United States knows exactly where every piece of Russian and Chinese military equipment on the planet is, as do they know where every piece of NATO, et cetera. So there's a real game that's going on between the two militaries and intelligence agencies and the deep government in this case, and then there's this TV show we're watching. It's hard to parse which is which.
But one of the things that Richard Black, Don DeBar said there is the fact that how Ukraine can be, in a sense, a proxy for the U.S. I mean, we know that there was a color revolution that happened in Ukraine, but we're looking at how just in the past days the Ukrainian president has changed stance. Another one of his quotes, Ukraine's stability is of great significance. And he said, U.S. is panic triggering alerts are placing a heavy burden on the economy. It seems like there's a diversion. Do you think there is one?
Yes, it is the case that President Zelensky has made the point repeatedly in the last days that certain forces in the West, typified by CNN, Truss of Britain, and others, are talking about an imminent invasion of Ukraine by Russia, which does not exist. The Ukrainian leadership keeps saying it does not exist. The Russian leadership has said it does not exist. So something very nasty and dangerous is coming out from what we had identified since the days of President Eisenhower as the military-industrial complex in the West. Today, Britain calls itself Global Britain and is pushing the pouring of weapons into Ukraine like mad. But step back a second. First of all, NATO became obsolete in 1991 when the Soviet Union disbanded. And what is required, the solution, is a new security architecture involving all of Europe, based on the principles of the Treaty of Westphalia of 1648, which ended massive religious warfare in Europe. The principle of diplomacy in a seemingly intractable situation is nations acting for the benefit of the other. I don't believe that President Biden wants a war with Russia. The American people don't want a war with Russia. And it's imperative that the United States...
What does he want then? What does he want when you say that? When you say Biden doesn't want a war with Russia, what does he want? Because it sure smells like one.
Not necessarily. If you look at the transcripts and the videos, the media continually attempts to goad him make provocative statements against Russia, and he keeps saying, we'll see a little bit, I'm not sure. I want to stress to you that there are significant forces in the United States, typified by former Ambassador Matlock to Russia, former Ambassador Chas Freeman to Saudi Arabia, former CIA Chief Graham Fuller in Afghanistan, who have all been calling very, very loudly and vociferously for a pullback of the U.S. offensive against Russia and calling for accepting the very recent proposals of the Russian Federation. Similarly, in Europe, many, many, many nations and leaders are saying this has to be slowed down.
Okay, let's get into that. I was going to get into that a little bit later, but Don DeBar, you had this interesting document which the U.S. decided not to release the details. It's very confusing as to the way that the U.S. approached this, not wanting to make it public, and for Russia to make parts of it public. But basically, I don't know if you saw that press conference where you had the U.S. Secretary of State presenting this document and saying, we're offering Russia a roadmap. But it sounded like it was a roadmap for the U.S. and not for Russia, because none of Russia's demands were met. But of course, he didn't want to come out and say that, Anthony Blinken. At the same time, he was very vociferous when it came to how much weapons they're giving Ukraine, how their allies, U.S. allies in the Baltic states, for example, that are going to be getting more weapons. It's almost as if the U.S. had the gun down Russia's throat, saying, if you don't follow what we are proposing, then this is what you're going to get. Did you get that impression?
Well, I saw the press conference. What he delivered was a reply document from the United States. There was one also that came from NATO. There were reply documents to a pair of proposals, again, one to the United States and one to NATO, that Russia delivered on December 17th of this past year. And it wasn't a roadmap. He used the word roadmap here, from Blinken's mouth. I'm thinking of this image from the Johnny Carson show when they used to say a fake commercial, meet at the fork of the road, and there'd be an actual fork and then a bunch of squiggly lines behind it, a map that was useless to anyone trying to go anywhere. Russia laid out very plainly what the concerns are that they have, that they would like to negotiate a settlement, you know, basically a global settlement with the United States and NATO, that you promised not to move your alliance up to our doorstep, in fact, not to even take military equipment into Eastern Germany at that time, East Germany, let alone into the Warsaw Pact countries, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the whole lot of them, Romania, Bulgaria. And so what happened instead was not only did they take most of the, and this was a point for Blinken, it's someone misspoke on a TV show on RT and said practically all instead of saying most, but almost every member of the Warsaw Pact is now a member of NATO, along with the three Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and some other Soviet republics. And then on top of that, you had an attempted coup in each of Belarus and Kazakhstan that are clearly tied to the CIA. I mean, there's been millions, and well, there was $5 billion, according to Victoria Nuland from the U.S. State Department, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, that was spent in, you know, the lead up to the Maidan coup, basically developing the communications infrastructure, including three TV stations that were used during the. This kind of thing has been going on in all of the old Soviet republics around Russia and in East Europe. And so Russia is seeing this, and they're seeing the troops that they fought when Germany invaded rolling in with greeted, you know, being greeted by the locals, realizing the troops are being placed there for them.
Well, you know, what's interesting about Richard Black, is the fact that in some cases we're looking at a Europe that has been somewhat conspicuously absent from the talks. I mean, remember the talks the week before where you had Wendy Sherman doing the negotiations with the Russian envoy at that point, and then there were news that it was the U.S. that was making the bidding for Europe, but not all European countries are on board. Why is it that Europe is not present, not actively present, when it comes to the talks?
Well, it is absolutely the case that there's a process that has emerged in Europe in which within many of NATO countries, the answer to war with Russia over Ukraine is absolutely no. Croatia has said we will not send troops. The Hungarian foreign minister is saying we need to negotiate long-term energy deals with Russia. Macron just had a long conversation yesterday with President Putin. President Putin just had a seminar with leading Italian industrialists earlier in the week, and a new one is being set up between German industrialists who want peace with Russia, a new video conference with President Putin. So in fact, it is the case that there, Blinken is lying, that there is a great deal of light between the positions of the nations of Europe and the United States, and Europe knows that it will go up in a nuclear holocaust, since it is the host to American nuclear weapons, if there's a war between, and let us be clear, we're talking about the possibility of a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. That's what's at stake here. And as I said earlier, I don't believe the U.S. Commander-in-Chief, this is my view, the Schiller Institute's view, it's not our view that the President, the Commander-in-Chief, President Biden, wants a nuclear war with Russia, and that's what's at stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that that's what's at stake, maybe that's why you're having these Eastern Ukraine talks, as it's called, Don DeBar, in which Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France are voicing support for what it seems like a ceasefire, maintaining a ceasefire.
Yes.
And this kind of is like the negotiations that were called the Normandy talks. Maybe you can take us back. It sounds an awful lot like the year 2014 when you had the Ukraine crisis, in a sense, break out, and then there were these talks. What were the Normandy talks? Are they feasible? Are those talks feasible to lay groundwork for a ceasefire? This will be for Don DeBar. Go ahead, Don DeBar. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Richard Black, get back to you.
Say Normandy, there's actually an agreement, the Minsk agreements. And the Minsk agreement was, in essence, the key parts of it, that the Eastern Ukraine republics, particularly, I believe, Donetsk and Lugansk, I don't remember if the third one was part of the agreement as to this part of the deal, they would become autonomous within, you know, the state of Ukraine. They would be autonomous governments, and this would resolve the contradiction between Kiev and the people that live in the east, in essence. Because The domestic political situation in Ukraine is fragmented. It has been for, you know, a very long time. The people in the East are ethnic Russians. The people in the West are a composite of ethnic Poles, Lithuanians, you know, and others from, you know, more or less Western Europe. You have the whole, you know, historic schism between the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic world. Kind of that's a fracture line also that runs right through it. And the cultures that have evolved over many years. And by the way, most of Ukraine in both of those spheres, up until the last century for sure or so, were part of Russia for centuries. And so there are many contradictions on the ground that represent political constituencies, for example, that Zelensky has to deal with. Like Zelensky came in, he was elected as a peacemaker. He was going to resolve this dispute between the West and the East. And he got elected despite that fact, not because of it, in the West, because he was a TV star. And I think that's why he was chosen as a candidate. Once mm-hmm. he got in, he has a balancing act with these constituencies on the ground.
Sure.
And there is a very strong fascist element that has a very strong shock troop on the ground constituent that he has to deal with. And the United States is using that as sort of a forward guard to intimidate Russia. And it's really dangerous the way that's playing out. I'm just going to go to one last little point. In the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, as it's called here, which is actually because the U.S. put missiles in Turkey in 1961, that when Kennedy did that, everybody involved, Robert McNamara, Fidel Castro, Khrushchev in his memoirs, tell you that it was sheer luck that we didn't have nuclear war. We're playing now, it literally, Russian roulette, firing another shot and hoping the chamber is empty.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if Joe Biden, no matter what his intentions are, is up to it the way that John Kennedy was. And that's what we're gambling with right now.
Gambling. Russian roulette. Richard Black. Provocations. This is very similar in a sense to what the U.S. is doing when it comes to the South China Sea and the way it's provoking China. I'm not too sure what foreign policy structure or plans the U.S. has by being involved in these big, what looks like adventures. Maybe you can tell us what is going on here. Because, you know, Russia and China, obviously these are big powers.
I think you probably know the answer to the question, which is that there's a faction in the Republican and Democratic Party and in the U.S. media as a whole, which wants the United States to be the world hegemon. And in the West, there's a very deep, deep global financial crisis. Hyperinflation is out of control. The debt structure in the entire West is a disaster. And what they're proposing as a solution is continued massive hyperinflation to keep the bubble going and the Green New Deal to get the world, including Iran, to get out of fossil fuels and out of nuclear. China is not accepting this. Russia is not accepting this. So China and Russia are both targets of this war faction in the West, which is proceeding out of desperation. At the same time, I would make the point that a new strategic element in the world as a whole is this unique collaboration now between China and Russia. They are inseparable from the standpoint of economic policy, development okay. policy, strategic policy, and therefore, in the West, those who would push the West towards war may be facing war against Russia and China simultaneously, and this hopefully will function as a wise deterrent.
Okay, Don DeBar, my last question to you quickly, if you can. The Chinese ambassador to the U.S. issued a warning, possible military conflict over Taiwan. So my question, what are the chances of the U.S. being involved in a military confrontation with China compared to one with Russia?
You want Jimmy the Greek, not me. That faction that Richard speaks of, by the way, exists. The faction is called Congress, the White House, Langley, the Pentagon, the Supreme Court, every other institution of power that the United States has, and the media. That is the war faction in this thing, the one that wants hegemony. There does not seem to be a constituency outside of the political forces organized around Trump and maybe somewhat around Sanders that are even willing to consider the possibility of a multipolar world rather than this hegemonic one that they've been striving for, certainly since 1991. But 1991 is really a product of their striving before that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Don DeBar, journalist and political activist there, and a radio host
from
Asenai. Richard Black, I'm sorry we're fresh out of time. Representative to the UN from the Schiller Institute, who spoke to us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We'll bring you on for another program, I'm sure. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahway, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Richard Ogg, a Silverhead former electrician who switched to making his living catching crabs 2 decades ago, is a staunch supporter of the union representing fishing boat captains along America's western seaboard. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Chris McGreal. The piece is titled, American fishers want to sue Big Oil for killing their trade. But there's a catch. Richard Ogg, Silverhead former electrician who switched to making his living catching crabs 2 decades ago, is a staunch supporter of the union representing fishing boat captains along America's western seaboard. But when he heard the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the PCFFA, was suing some of the world's largest oil companies for causing the climate crisis, Richard Ogg took stock of the barrels of diesel oil stacked on his vessel, the 54-foot Karen Jean, and wondered if the litigation was not only a mistake, but hypocritical. How do we run our engines without oil? How do we fish without oil? Electricity? I'm a small vessel, I'm only 68 tons, and my God, I don't know how that would work, said Ogg, who fishes out of Bodega Bay, about 70 miles north of San Francisco, California. The environmental harm brought by rising ocean temperatures has severely undercut fishing seasons and supplies at a steep cost to the industry. And so, in response to years of setbacks, union leaders pursued a novel strategy to reclaim lost earnings by going after one of the culprits responsible for driving global temperatures. 3 years ago, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the PCFFA, became the first private organization to join the growing number of lawsuits accusing the oil and gas industry of covering up research that warned about the dangers of burning fossil fuels. The plaintiffs want compensation for damage caused by global heating and to meet the cost of new infrastructure to cope with the climate crisis. They also demand the oil industry change its ways. Richard Ogg is not alone among West Coast fishing boat owners in questioning the association's lawsuit. And the head of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, Mike Conroy, knows it. When I first heard of this lawsuit, I had the very same thought. This is ridiculous, Conroy said. Mike Conroy said he understands the lawsuit looks hypocritical to many people because the fishing industry is so dependent on oil. But he said his views shifted when he looked more closely at the actions of the fossil fuel industry, particularly its cover-up of the warnings from its own scientists and its continued efforts to undermine measures to contain global heating. This skepticism among Conroy's members about suing big oil reflects sharp divisions in American society about responsibility for the deepening environmental emergency and the challenges litigants face in attempting to hold the industry to account. It's controversial, I get it, Mike Conroy adds, but then I learned that these oil companies were doubling down on these things they knew were bad. And if we're putting forth effort to reduce our impacts on the climate, then we shouldn't be doing that alone. The Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, representing about 900 family-owned fishing boats on the Pacific Coast, sued after a surge in blooms of toxic algae shut down fishing for Dungeness crab. The crabs are Oregon's most valuable catch, pumping about $75 million a year into the state's economy, and account for about one quarter of California's revenues from fishing. In 2013, a huge pool of warm water that became known as the Blob appeared off the Pacific coast. 2 years later, the Blob had grown to more than 2,000 miles long, running from the Mexican border to Alaska. Water temperatures rose to 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.5 degrees Celsius above normal, causing an increase in the neurotoxin domoic acid that delayed the opening of the 2015 Dungeness crab season along the west coast of the United States by months. The shutdown cost more than $100 million in lost earnings and wages by some estimates. Two-thirds of boats were docked, and others had to move to different fisheries. The total catch was only about half of a normal year. I know a number of folks that lost their boats, they lost their homes, they lost their families, said Mike Conroy. Commercial crabbers face shortened seasons again in the following years because toxicity levels remained high and marine heat waves shifted krill closer to the shore, drawing endangered humpback and blue whales into crabbing areas where they are in danger of becoming entangled in fishing lines. In its lawsuit, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations blamed the Blob on global heating caused by the burning of fossil fuels and is seeking compensation for a harmful algal bloom unprecedented in its extent and in its persistence. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration study last year concluded that climate change is likely to result in a sharp rise in marine heat waves and a perpetuation of toxic blooms that might otherwise have washed away, with domoic acid hotspots becoming more frequent and more intense. The Dungeness crab season was again delayed last year on parts of the West Coast after new domoic acid hotspots were identified off the coast of Oregon, including near the port of Newport. Clint Funderburg, a member of the Oregon Coast Crab Association who fishes out of Newport, said he was reluctant to pin responsibility for the domoic acid outbreak solely on the climate crisis, and therefore the fossil fuel industry. They were some hard years, but these problems come and go. I'm not saying there isn't climate change, but there's a history of domoic acid on this coast, and I don't know if we can say it's one thing or the other causing it, he said. Richard Ogg does domoic acid testing for the state along a 30-mile stretch of coast in his area. He said the readings are consistently up, but like other fishing, his Pacific coast, he notices that it coincides with an intensification of the vineyard industry. Climate change definitely is real. We know that, and it is impacting us. But it's really, at times, a cyclical thing. What we're looking at is a combination of a lot of things that are breaking down the system. It's not one thing in particular, he said. Toxic algae blooms have made regular appearances along America's west coast. An outbreak is believed responsible for the Great Bird Frenzy around beachside communities in Santa Cruz, California in 1961, which played a part in shaping Alfred Hitchcock's classic film, The Birds. But the intensity of the recent outbreaks and the scale of the blob has scientists worried. Studies also show that the ocean is absorbing more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, making it more acidic. Among other things, higher acid levels affects the ability of crustaceans to build their shells. In the early 2000s, the increased acidity killed off large numbers of young oysters and mussels unable to form shells. Last year, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, released a study that showed that baby Dungeness crabs were being exposed to the same corrosive waters. Still, there remains the question of culpability. We all use diesel on our boats, said Clint Funderburg. I'm not going to point the finger just at the oil companies. They sell it, we buy it. The oil and gas industry has spent years deflecting from its central part in global heating, pushing the claim that it is doing no more than selling a legal product and that it is the individual user who bears responsibility for putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Four of the companies sued by the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, that is Chevron, Exxon, BP, and Shell, are responsible for more than 10% of the world's carbon emissions since 1965. 19 of the 20 largest carbon emitters over the same period were oil and gas producers. But the major polluters have had some success in following the tactic of the tobacco industry and gun makers in seeking to disperse responsibility by putting the onus on individual user rather than the manufacturers. A Guardian opinion poll published in October showed that strategy has paid off, with 31% of the American public saying that individuals are completely or mostly responsible for the climate crisis. For his part, Richard Ogg is fatalistic. The problem for me is suing. It never seems to solve the problem. The oil companies aren't going to be hurt by a lawsuit. In fact, they want to continue, and they're going to continue, he said. Mike Conroy sees it differently. He says the lawsuit is intended to punish bad behavior and pressure the oil industry into changing its ways. A lot of my members don't have the time to sit back and actually give this a lot of thought, which is unfortunate. But after the last crab season in California, I think more and more of the fishermen are starting to ask questions that need to be asked, he said.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.